Absolutely. Hi, everyone. It's great to be here, and I want to start off by thanking the organizers for having me here. So my name is Hagop Pashan. I'm from the University of Sydney, and what I'll be talking to you about is joint work with Stephen Bartlett from the University of Sydney and David Gross from the University of Cologne. Okay, so to start off, maybe I'll summarize this project in a couple of sentences. So this project is really about different notions of simulation. About what these different notions of simulation might teach us about the differences between classical and quantum computational power. So to start off, I want you to think of this square as the set of all quantum computational tasks. So the set of all problems that a quantum computer can solve. There's been a lot of recent activity in two lines of research on this topic, or related to this topic. So on the left here, we have a bunch of results on classical simulability of quantum circuits. So a prominent example is the Gauss-Manil theorem, which simulates stabilizer circuits. But we also have nearest neighbor match gate circuits and circuits with positive quasi-probabilistic representations. And for those who don't know, this harnesses this really nice machinery that takes the standard description of quantum circuits in terms of input states, unitaries, and measurements, and transforms them into a kind of probabilistic description of the quantum circuit. And here, the density states get mapped into probability distributions or quasi-probability distributions. Unitaries get mapped into conditional probability distributions or mappings between probability distributions, and so on. Essentially, what happens is, for some circuits, when you do this mapping, everything is positive and things look like real probability distributions. And in that case, you can treat the system like a stochastic process, and there's techniques available in order to simulate the quantum circuit. That's what the simulation refers to. And a related method is one where you have a situation where this mapping gives you negativities, and so things can't necessarily be interpreted as probability distributions, but nonetheless, there's some way of quantifying how much negativity appears in these circuits. As long as that negativity is low enough, polynomially bounded, then there's still classical methods for simulating these families of quantum circuits. Okay, this is by no means an exhaustive list of all computational tasks that are classically achievable, but just to give you some examples. So on the flip side, we have a whole bunch of results about the hardness of classically simulating a family of quantum circuits. Okay, so now there's a famous result by Aronson and Arkhipov on the hardness of boson sampling. Also, Bremner et al. Showed the hardness of sampling from IQP circuits. We have hardness of Fourier sampling and one clean qubit model. Again, not exhaustive, and you don't need to know the details of how these things work. But I should just say that both these lines of work are important and well-motivated, and they teach us something very interesting. But for me, the thing that's kind of most interesting and exciting about this is kind of this idea that the computational complexity of quantum mechanics is physical law. Incredibly, we kind of have a very little understanding of the computational complexity of quantum mechanics and how it relates to classical physics. And I think it's kind of very inspiring to think of this picture in that setting, and that's what really drives me. So a natural question that kind of is raised when you look at this picture is to ask, what happens when we push these techniques to their limits? What emerges as like the transition? And a very related question is there some conceptual framework that underpins these results and tells us why some things are classically simulable and other things are hard? Okay, but there's some problems or some clarifications to be made about this picture. So first off, let's note that the set of all quantum computational tasks or quantum solvable problems, actually there's different types. So we have decision problems, function problems, sampling problems. And so I'm just going to set up some notation and maybe remind you of some of these if you're already familiar with them. So decision problems are essentially maps from finite length bit strings to a yes or no answer. And so each instance is some bit string, and it gets mapped to a yes or no. And so a function defines a decision problem. And there's a related cousin to these called the promise decision problem, where an algorithm only needs to make the correct decision on some promise set of instances, not necessarily every possible instance. OK, sampling problems are quite a different creature. So sampling problems are defined by a function that maps finite length bit strings to families of probability distributions. So every instance A gets mapped to a probability distribution. And the task now is to sample from the probability distribution associated with a given instance. Okay? So essentially, we can think of this instance A as some implicit description of a probability distribution, and our task is to sample from that distribution. So to maybe make this more concrete or related to quantum circuits, here is kind of a generic quantum circuit. We have some input state, some unitary that might be built up from some finite gate set. Now, measurement is done, and then what's produced at the end is some bit string that encodes the measurements, and it's a classical random variable. Okay, so we can use a family of quantum circuits to define a decision problem or a sampling problem. And so the way we, a nice way to think about this is essentially this instance to the problem is really a description of a circuit. So once you've kind of picked some dictionary that describes a circuit in terms of a bit string, then every bit string gives you a description of a circuit. And then once you've done that, you can encode the decision into whether the first bit is overwhelmingly likely to be a one or a zero. But you can also define a sampling problem this way, because if you describe a circuit through this bit string, then you've implicitly defined a probability distribution, namely the distribution that describes the statistics of the outcomes. And it's quite clear that a quantum computer can very naturally solve this problem. You just need to run the circuit that's described by the instance, and the outcome will be a sample from the probability distribution. Okay, so what is kind of clear to see is that essentially sampling problems are the most general kind of problems that a quantum computer solves, and that's really the one we should be focusing on rather than decision problems. Okay, another complication with this picture is the fact that there are actually many notions of simulation. And I was presenting this as though there was just one notion of simulation. So here I've written down five notions of simulation, and I've categorized them in terms of estimation tasks and sampling tasks. So the estimation tasks estimate vulnerable probabilities to various degrees of accuracy, and the sampling tasks sample from approximate distributions, distributions approximating the true quantum one, to different levels of accuracy. And we'll note that these different notions match up to different results. And so there's lots of different results. Now, having lots of different notions of simulation is not a bad thing. It's actually a very good thing, because it enriches our understanding of the interplay between classical and quantum. But it also creates some complications. There's room for confusion, and there's also things that we might presume from looking at this picture that aren't necessarily true. So for example, one might think that because you can classically simulate some part of quantum mechanics, that might suggest that there's no problems that that quantum system can solve that a classical computer cannot solve. And that would not be true under some notions of simulation. On the flip side, you might think that if you can't classically simulate some quantum system, then maybe there's something that a quantum computer can do that a classical computer cannot do, and that's also not true. Okay, so in order to kind of conclude things about the ability to solve problems, in order to make conclusions about computational power, you need to choose a notion of simulation that respects computational power. Okay, and I'll talk about this notion epsilon simulation and show you why this is the notion that does that. So the other thing you might want to do is relate other notions to this so that maybe you can draw some conclusions about other, make use of all these algorithms that have been constructed and maybe draw some conclusions about computational bow from them as well. And so here I'm going to give you an overview of our results. And this is going to also double as a talk outline. Okay, so essentially, what we're going to do is think of this C as a family of quantum circuits or some quantum computer. And in general, it won't be a universal quantum computer. And then what we're going to do is ask a bunch of questions about various properties of the quantum computer with the aim of trying to decide whether this quantum computer is classically simulable or hard to simulate. But in order for this statement to have some bearing on the computational power or the kinds of problems that this thing can solve, we need to make sure that we choose this notion of simulation that respects computational power. And so I'm going to define epsilon simulation. And then the first part of the results is showing that some of these really strong notions of simulation automatically imply epsilon simulation. I won't actually discuss these in the talk, but they're in the appendix of the paper. I'll then define a much weaker notion of simulation, which I call a polybox. And I'll also define a notion of, or a property of families of quantum circuits called polysparsity. And then we'll kind of show that a polybox and polysparsity together imply an epsilon simulator. And finally, I will talk about why a polybox is strictly weaker than an epsilon simulator by showing some examples of quantum circuits that admit a polybox and are hard to epsilon simulate. And finally, we'll discuss some open questions. Okay, so you don't need to take all of this in now because this will keep popping up throughout the presentation. But let's start off with a notion of simulation. So what do we want from a simulator that respects computational power? Well, here's some desiderata. So first off, we want if B simulates A, then B can solve all problems that A can solve. We want this property. And another thing we might want is that if B cannot simulate A, then B cannot solve all problems solvable by A. So there's at least some problem that A can solve that B cannot. Okay. And with this in mind, let's consider the following computational task. So we have Alice, who has some family of quantum circuits. And we also have Bob, who has some kind of simulation scheme. And now one of either Alice or Bob is randomly chosen to become the candidate. And so here is the candidate, and their identity is hidden behind this mask. So we don't know if it's Alice or Bob, okay? Some computationally unbounded referee is to decide if the candidate is Alice or Bob through some interactive protocol with the candidate. And so the referee says to the candidate, run this circuit. And the candidate responds. And then conditioned on this response, the referee can ask further questions. In that case, run this circuit, and so on. And at some point in this protocol, the referee is to decide to stop and declare who they think the candidate is, whether it's Alice with the quantum computer or Bob with a simulator. And so the aim of the referee is to be correct with high probability, or in fact, to be correct with any probability that's a fixed amount better than a random guess. And the aim of Bob is to have some kind of strategy such that if he is chosen to be the candidate, he will be efficiently indistinguishable from Alice's output. So we need to unpack this efficiently indistinguishable. So what indistinguishable means is essentially for any chosen margin above a random guess, he should be able to ensure that the referee will fail. And what efficient means is that for any given sequence of circuits the referee might ask for, the runtime of Bob should be polynomially equivalent to the runtime of Alice in returning a response.
The referee is computationally unbounded, but the communication is polynomial as well?
No, it's not. The referee can ask as many questions as they like.
Okay. So polynomial equivalent, because it could, if it's exponentially many questions, then Alice also has to answer exponentially questions.
Yes. We'll note that this notion of efficient indistinguishability is jointly sufficient and necessary for this desiderata, because if the output of Bob is indistinguishable, then this means there's no computational problem that Alice could solve and Bob couldn't, because this could be used by the referee in order to distinguish them. On the other hand, if a simulator is not efficiently distinguishable, then that means Bob cannot achieve this task. But Alice can achieve this task with her quantum computer, which means that there's a problem that Alice could solve and Bob cannot. Okay. So this tells us that this is a nice candidate that enforces this requirement, but let me now define the notion of epsilon simulation and talk about why we set up this interactive protocol. So to define an epsilon simulator, I'm going to first introduce some notation by talking about what a quantum computer is, which I'm sure you don't need me to explain to you, but essentially we're going to think of this box as a family of quantum circuits, and we can input any description into any circuit description into this box, and this box is going to run that circuit and output some measurement outcome according to some statistics that describe the statistics of the quantum circuit. And there's going to be some resource cost associated with running this circuit, whether that's runtime or number of PhD students required to operate this machine, you make a pick. Okay, so an epsilon simulator is a very, very similar device, except it has this extra input. So into an epsilon simulator goes a description of a quantum circuit, but also some epsilon greater than zero. And what comes out is something that looks like a measurement outcome, but it might be distributed differently from the quantum computer's measurement outcome. And again, there's some resource cost. And so for a device with these inputs and outputs to satisfy the definition of an epsilon simulator, we require these three properties to hold. So firstly, this device needs to be classical, which means it runs a classical algorithm. Secondly, the output probability distribution that it samples from must be within the epsilon ball of the true quantum probability distribution. And here, the metric we use is the total variation distance, or the L1 norm. And further, we require this to hold for every choice of C and for every epsilon greater than zero. And there's a resource cost associated with this. So the runtime of this machine must be upper bounded by a polynomial in the number of qubits and in one on epsilon, this accuracy parameter. So essentially, this device can achieve arbitrary accuracy, right? You can get as close as you like to sampling from the distribution of the quantum computer, but you give the device more time to do so. So as epsilon decreases, the device gets more time. And it's important that this relationship is like this and doesn't have a log or an exponential in front of it. I probably won't get into that detail. But the reason we have this definition is that it's motivated by this theorem. So it says that in the interactive protocol we just discussed, Bob can achieve efficient indistinguishability if and only if he has an epsilon simulator. And so to unpack the two directions of this statement, so in one direction it says that if the simulator captures the computational power of the simulated, then it must be an epsilon simulator. And in the other side, it says if the simulator is an epsilon simulator, then it captures the computational power of a quantum computer. Okay. So that defines an epsilon simulator. And now we kind of have this nice definition set up, and we can go on to defining this much weaker notion of simulation called the polybox. So here's a quantum computer again, and before I define a polybox, I want to just clarify what I mean by an event. So an event is a set of outcomes. So you run a quantum computer and you see some bit string, it represents a measurement outcome, that's one outcome, but you might want to talk about a set of outcomes such as this. So here there's two outcomes in this event. And I'm going to use some compact notation for representing these. So this wildcard notation, or this bullet symbol, essentially means you could have either measurement outcome have occurred on that qubit. Okay, so this event and this event are equivalent. But I should also point out that not all events can be written using this notation. And so here's an example of an event that can't be written using this notation. So this is a length k bit string where the parity is one. And if you try to write any length k string with a bullet in it, you'll include both parities automatically. So you can't write all events this way. Okay, so we've talked about an event. And so let's give a very rough idea of what a polybox does. Essentially, a polybox estimates probabilities of events. So you can ask a polybox a question like, if I run this quantum circuit, what is the probability that the outcome it produces is in this event? Okay? And so here's the more kind of technical definition. So a polybox takes in a description of a quantum circuit, two accuracy parameters, epsilon and delta greater than zero, and also a description of an event of this form. And then what it outputs is the estimate of the probability that if you run this circuit, you will observe an outcome that's in E. Okay? And again, this thing takes some resources to run. And for a device with these inputs and outputs to satisfy the definition of a polybox, it needs to meet these three criteria. So again, it's got to be a classical device. It's got to have the following accuracy requirement, which essentially says that the estimate it produces has to be epsilon close to the target estimate with high probability, with probability greater than 1 minus delta.
Can you say again, it's outputting the probability or it's outputting...
Yeah, sorry, this is a little bit confusing all the time because there's the estimate is a probability, and so we're talking about probabilities of errors in the probabilities, right? So the output is a probability, so it's the probability of the event occurring, but I'm just going to call that the target quantity just to avoid confusion. So the error in the target quantity is upper bounded by an epsilon with high probability. And the reason there's this second probability here is because this machine in general can be probabilistic. So it doesn't have to be evaluating functions. It can have some randomness in what it outputs, but we need it with 1 minus delta probability to be within epsilon of the correct quantity. So in addition to this accuracy requirement, which also has to hold for all circuits, but also for all E and epsilon greater than zero, sorry, for all epsilon and delta greater than zero, and all events of this form. In addition, we have a runtime requirement. And the runtime requirement is that it's got to be polynomially upper bounded in N, in 1 on epsilon, and in log of 1 on delta. And again, the way these things scale is important, but I won't go into the details, but it's important in some of the proofs. Maybe one point of clarification is that these epsilon simulators produce different kinds of output to what polyboxes produce. So an epsilon simulator produces bit strings. They look like measurement outcomes. They look like what a quantum computer will output, whereas a polybox produces probabilities. So ideally, if it's not too wrong, it's got to be a real number between 0 and 1. Okay, so we've kind of done all this hard work and defined this thing called a polybox, and we should justify this definition. Why did we do this? So what is the utility of a polybox? Well, first of all, a polybox can be useful for the construction of an epsilon simulator, and we're going to see this later. But also, if a family of quantum circuits does not admit a polybox, then immediately we know that it does not admit an epsilon simulator. So whether or not something admits a polybox tells us something about its ability to admit an epsilon simulator, and for this reason, it's an important concept. But in addition, if C admits a polybox, then this tells us that C cannot solve any decision problems outside of classical. In fact, it can't solve any decisions outside of classical even when we give C a little bit of classical help. To maybe clarify what I mean by this, recall that when we talked about decision problems solvable by C, we could define these problems by having each instance describe a circuit, and then the decision was encoded into the first bit, and the probability of the first bit being overwhelmingly likely to be a 1 or a 0. Now, we could, in principle, talk about a decision problem that's maybe a little bit more complicated. So now our instances specify not only a circuit, but also an event. So we could imagine, given an A, you look at the first half of the bits, and it specifies a circuit, and the second half of the bits specifies an event. And then you might encode a decision as follows. You've described the circuit, and now you've described the statistics of the outcome. And then you could talk about the probability of the outcome being in the event E or not in the event E. And so you could encode your decision into whether or not you're overwhelmingly likely to be in E or not in E. Okay. But you will note that C might not be able to do this on its own. Because while C has the ability to run the circuit and produce the output, it can't necessarily decide if the output is in the event or not. Okay? In order to make that decision, you might need to give C some help. And so if you give it some additional computational resource to ensure that one can check membership in this event, then C plus this additional resource can solve the decision problems defined this way. Okay? And you might say, well, you know, we were talking about events of this form, and they're very simple events. And a very simple sub-universal classical computer could solve this. So you know, why wouldn't C solve it? Why are you wasting our time? And the reason is that, in general, when we think about C, we're not thinking about universal quantum computers. So we could be thinking about sub-universal quantum computers that maybe can't make this decision. Okay? And in that case, it turns out that if you take this C and even give it this slightly additional computational power to decide membership, then even this device cannot do problems that the polybox cannot do, right? So in this sense, a polybox captures the computational power of decision making by C plus some added computational assistance. But yet another problem, yet another reason why this notion is useful is that there's many interesting families of quantum circuits that admit a polybox. Okay, and three such examples are listed here. The first is a family of quantum circuits which we call C-prod. This is a family of quantum circuits where you allow input of an arbitrary product state. And then all the gates must be Clifford. And the measurements must be done at the end in the computational basis. So this family of quantum circuits is quite similar to the magic state injection model, which is universal, and this is not. And the key point of difference is that in the magic state injection model, you allow intermediate measurements and conditioning on these, whereas in this model, you get rid of that conditioning. But it lets you inject, it lets you input things like magic states. There's also this family of quantum circuits called IQP circuits, which take inputs of the all zero state, and then you can do any gate that's diagonal in the X basis, and finally you do a computational basis measurement. And finally, this family of quantum circuits I referred to earlier, where the circuits have a polynomially bounded negativity, is another example. So all three of these things admit a polybox. Okay. So we've defined polysparsity, and we're almost through the definitions, but I've got to give you one more definition, which is, we've defined a polybox, but I've got to also define polysparsity. Now, polysparsity is a property of a family of quantum circuits. Polysparsity is measuring how spread out or peaked the distributions that are generated by this family of quantum circuits are. Okay, and here is a very very compact definition, which is maybe not so accessible in terms of the smooth max entropy of these distributions. So it says that 2 to the smooth max entropy of these distributions must be upper bounded by a polynomial in n and epsilon. Let me unpack that for you. We have a family of probability distributions that is defined by a family of quantum circuits. And we can pick any probability distribution out of this family. And we can sort out, so in general, that's going to be like 2 to the n possible outcomes that could be produced by this circuit. And we can sort the outcomes from most likely to least likely. And when we do so, okay, we get a picture that looks like this, and we can look at the t most likely outcomes, and then we can look at the mass of the tail of this distribution beyond the t most likely outcomes. And in this case, we can define epsilon as a function of t. So epsilon is some number between 0 and 1, which tells us the mass of the tail beyond the t most likely outcome. And we can of course invert this relationship and get t as a function of epsilon. So now we can think of this quantity as the number of most likely outcomes you need to remove out of a distribution to be left with a tail that's less than epsilon. Okay? And in fact, the log of this quantity is known as the smooth max entropy. And so now what polysparsity is the requirement that for any probability distribution you pick or any quantum circuit you pick, you will have the property that this t epsilon is upper bounded by a polynomial in the number of qubits divided by epsilon. Okay. So maybe to give you some simple examples of things that have this property of polysparsity, any family of probability distributions where every member distribution has polynomial size support is an example of a polysparse thing, but it's kind of a simple example of polysparse things. And also any family of distributions where you have for every size a distribution which looks like the uniform on some portion of the 2 to the n space is an example of something that does not satisfy polysparsity. So if your family of quantum circuits can always generate the uniform distribution for every n, that family is not going to be polysparse. So in some sense, polysparsity is a very maybe somewhat natural thing to expect or want from a family of quantum circuits that's going to be used to solve a problem. Because we tend to think, and this is not necessarily how problems are solved, but one tends to think that when you run a quantum computer in order to solve some problem, that there's some exponential size space of possible outcomes, but if the circuit's to solve your problem, then it's going to kind of pick out an answer out of this exponential size space. Or at worst, it's at least going to pick out some polynomial size set near the answer that's kind of close to the answer. And so an example where this happens is if you wanted to estimate the phase of some unitary, if you input the eigenvector of that unitary, you get the eigenvalue using phase estimation, and the distribution of phases you will get will have this property of being within like polynomial support. Okay, so that's polysparsity. Okay, and then I'm going to very very briefly show you how the property of a polybox and polysparsity together can be put together in order to construct an epsilon simulator. Okay, so this is going to be a very rough sketch, but essentially we know we have a polybox, and we know that the family of circuits we're trying to estimate has this polysparsity condition. And what we're trying to do is achieve this. We're trying to build this. How do we lift the polybox to this? Well, if we had this, then for any circuit and for any epsilon, we have to be able to sample from some probability distribution that is epsilon close to the target probability distribution. But because we know this family is polysparse, we know something about this target probability distribution. Namely, that we could truncate this target probability distribution, and the tail will be somewhat small compared to the somewhat small, and so we could kind of try to sample from this truncated probability distribution. And so we're going to use this property. So we're going to lose half of this epsilon in some truncation procedure. And then when we truncate, we know that the number of most likely outcomes we will need to keep in our truncated distribution is going to be like some kind of polynomial. So it's going to be manageable in terms of computation. But we don't know what the probability distribution is. So even if we truncated it, we don't know where these most likely outcomes lie, right? There's some exponential space, and in it there are some polynomially many outcomes that are sprinkled in, and we don't know where they are. There's this really nice algorithm that's in this paper by Schwartz and van der Nest, and it's based on an algorithm by Koshlevitz and Mansell. And this algorithm can essentially be used to find these polynomially many most likely outcomes in this exponential size space. And once you've found it, then you could compute each of these to sufficient accuracy in order to be able to sample from the distribution with required distance. I should point out that in order to find these likely outcomes, you need something like a polybox, which you run multiple times, and you have to feed into it different kinds of events. So you feed into it different events with different amounts of marginalization in a kind of very clever way to find the most likely outcomes. Okay, so that's a rough sketch of how this algorithm works. The next thing I want to do is...
If you have an epsilon simulator that does or does not give you a polybox?
It does give you a polybox, yes. So next thing I want to talk about is showing that a polybox is somehow a strictly weaker notion than epsilon simulation. So to do this, what we need to do is find some family of quantum circuits which admit a polybox, but then we can show that it cannot admit an epsilon simulator. Okay, so let me sketch this out, and such a family is going to be this guy, CE, and this E stands for encode. So it's some family of quantum circuits, C encode. And what's going on inside here, although we can't see it, we wouldn't be able to see it normally, what's hidden inside this box is a universal quantum computer along with some classical random number generator. And so what happens when you feed a description of a circuit into this machine is that that circuit gets run on this universal quantum computer and some output X is produced. But in addition, we look at the number of qubits used and feed that into this random number generator, which samples from uniformly from bit strings of length n, okay, and it produces some noise y. And then what we output in the end is a bit string of length n plus 1, where the first bit is the first bit of the universal quantum computer, but added to it is the parity of the noise. And then finally, we output the entire bit string y, which is the noise. Okay, so it seems like a strange thing to do, but it has its use. So specifically, what we can do with this is show that we can construct a polybox for CE, which can estimate the probability of Z, this output, being in any event of this form. And it can estimate this probability deterministically to additive error of 2 to the minus n. Okay, so very accurately, all the time, we can do this estimate. And that's an efficient classical device that does this. But we will also note that unless you're willing to believe that BQP equals BPP, that this shouldn't admit an epsilon simulator. And the reason is that if you could sample from Z to arbitrarily small L1 norm, or even 0.1 L1 norm, then you'll be able to very easily recover X1 simply by taking this, computing the parity, and adding it to the first register. Okay? So this gives you a proof that a polybox is a weaker notion of simulation than an epsilon simulator, and that's witnessed by this fairly contrived construction. Okay? But maybe a natural question you might ask is, are there actually like more natural families of quantum circuits that we might be interested in that have this property of admitting a polybox but not an epsilon simulator? And it turns out that there are. And the two examples we came up with were IQP circuits and also these C-prod circuits. So to put these in that category, for IQP circuits, we needed to construct a polybox for them. And we didn't need to do the hardness proof of epsilon simulation because there was already an existing hardness proof with a different notion of simulation, which easily reduced to a hardness of epsilon simulation. For C prod circuits, we explicitly constructed a polybox, but also constructed a hardness proof showing that you shouldn't be able to epsilon simulate these. If you're willing to accept some now somewhat standard complexity theoretic conjectures about polynomial hierarchy not collapsing and the average case hardness of certain circuit estimating certain probabilities. Okay. I mean, this pretty much gives us a complete picture of the stuff we've done. Before I kind of go on to discussing some open questions, I might just give you some examples to show you how to apply this or how these things work. So an example of a circuit you might insert where the answer to this question is yes, so it admits some strong notion of simulation, is the stabilizer formalism. And thus you can conclude that it admits an epsilon simulator. Circuits that you might say no to these strong notions of simulation, and then also no to this weak notion of simulation of a polybox, we might expect that universal quantum circuits, or even universal quantum circuits with a logarithmic number of bits being measured, or even just one bit being measured, will all fall in this category. Examples that do admit a polybox and are not polysparse are all of these examples here. C poly N, these C product circuits, IQP circuits, and these encoded circuits I just discussed. But we could always artificially impose the polysparsity condition by restricting the number of qubits we measure on these. And as soon as we do so, they now will be polysparse, and hence we can go straight to epsilon simulation, and that's why they appear here. Okay, so that's pretty much all of it. So maybe I'll go to some open questions. Okay, so one of the natural extensions of this, that doesn't mean it will be easy, but it's natural, is you will note that in the interactive protocol that we set up, we had a referee that was computationally unbounded. And so the notion of indistinguishability we were using was some information theoretic notion of indistinguishability. And you might ask what happens when I think about it in terms of a computational theoretic indistinguishability. And so this would constitute a weakening of the notion of simulation and what it means to solve a problem. So we'd be saying you'd have to kind of physically justify this to say that, well, if there's no physical process that can distinguish between these two things, then what does it mean to say that Alice solves this problem and Bob does not? Okay. And if you make this argument, then you might want to go through this procedure and derive a slightly weaker notion of simulation than epsilon simulation that still holds this property of respecting computation with respect to this new notion. So it's something you might want to consider. And maybe a possible application or something that might help you deal with along the way is kind of raised by these papers. So these papers talk about classically simulating noisy boson sampling and noisy IQP. So it turns out while there's hardness proofs for these things, if you add a bit of depolarizing noise to these systems, it becomes easy to classically simulate, okay? Except both of these results use a notion of simulation that is weaker than epsilon simulation. And so you can't draw the conclusion that based on these results, these noisy IQP circuits or these noisy boson sampling circuits cannot solve any problems that a classical computer cannot solve. Okay, but maybe if you made this argument, then you could justify that any problem that they can solve can only be seen by in an information theoretic sense, but not in a computational theoretic sense. Okay, so that might be one motivation for doing this. Another open question is to kind of explore the relationship between polysparsity and anti-concentration. So I haven't talked about anti-concentration, but essentially it's a assumption or something that's proven in all these hardness results. So whenever they prove the hardness of boson sampling or IQP or whatever, they use this property of anti-concentration. And essentially, if a family of quantum circuits anti-concentrates, then the distribution is spread out. Over random choices of circuits, the distribution is spread out. Somehow polysparsity is the flip opposite of this, right? In some sense, polysparsity is peakness in these distributions. These notions aren't exactly matching, so there's some work to kind of actually make them consistent. And so it turns out, our results say you need polysparsity to lift polyboxes to epsilon simulators. The hardness results say you need anti-concentration in order to show hardness. And the question is, can we generalize these notions and make them closer to each other? Can we push these to the limit? Maybe there's some room in strengthening our theorems, okay, on both sides, both simulation by weakening the polysparsity requirement, and in hardness by weakening the anti-concentration requirement for these proofs to still go through. Okay, so maybe these are somewhat incremental changes. And I think a very interesting open question that is quite exciting is the following. So these works here, in a sense, kind of distilled quantumness. So what these papers did is look at in the magic state injection picture. You can look at some circuit that has computational qubits and magic states, and then you do some sequence of Clifford operations, and then with conditioning, and at the end of this procedure, you've done some computation. Okay, and this computation is universal. And what they were able to do is show that you can somehow take this circuit and reduce it, make it much smaller, so that you only have magic states being inserted. And somehow all the computational qubits could have been taken offline and been classically computed using Gottesman-Neil, and those classical computations would interact with the quantum procedure, but somehow what you've done is taken a big quantum circuit and made it into a much smaller quantum circuit that captures all the hardness, and everything else is taken offline and done classically, okay? So in some sense, they're kind of distilling quantum computation. And I suppose this is a weak analogy to what I would consider doing here. So here I've got this diagram where we have on this axis the computational power of quantum circuits. So things to the right of this vertical line have universal computational power, quantum universal, and things to the left of this line are classical. And there seems to be stuff in this intermediate regime that's neither universal nor classical. And the vertical axis here splits us up in terms of the strength of the notion of simulation. So things above this horizontal line can be epsilon simulated, and things above this horizontal line admit a polybox, okay? And families of quantum circuits can only live in the colored regions. Because, for example, if there was a family of quantum circuits that lived here, then it's classical, but not epsilon simulable, and that can't happen. Okay, so if we do this and now populate it with maybe some examples that we know about, we find that there's actually things in this middle region, okay, and that's interesting. We find that maybe in addition to these, there's some more stuff in the middle region. So I'm almost certain that circuits that are polynomially bounded in negativity fall in this category, and it's a distinct possibility that boson sampling also falls in this category. So interestingly, for boson sampling to fall in this category, it has to admit a polybox, and we know that boson sampling kind of almost admits a polybox in some sense. So there's this Goerwitz algorithm, which gives us the ability to estimate probabilities of outcomes, and there's another algorithm that gives us the ability to estimate probabilities of marginals, but there's some intermediate region where if you only marginalize over, say, half of the registers, there's no known algorithm for boson sampling in that setting, which kind of prevents us from claiming that boson sampling has a polybox. But in any case, there's a bunch of examples of families of quantum circuits that fall in this intermediate regime. But the reason this is interesting is because everything above this line is computationally boring, in the sense that it can't do any problem that a classical computer can't do. But everything above this line is computationally boring without classical help, because we showed that it can't do any decision problem without more help. And so we end up with this situation where either with classical help, these can solve problems outside of BPP, which essentially says that BPP is a strict subset of a classical device given access to something that can sample from the output of these circuits. Or with classical help, these things still cannot solve things outside of BPP. So BPP is equal to BPP with this oracle, which must be true, even though we know that somehow these things should be able to sample things that a classical device cannot sample from. So if they can, because these things admit hardness proofs for epsilon simulation, it means these things can sample distributions that you can't efficiently sample from classically, according to these proofs. So this kind of suggests that, and this was an interesting question that was raised by Scott. So Scott raised this question in the special case where you're looking at does BQP equals BPP imply that SAMP-P equals SAMP-BQP? Okay. In other words, does equivalence between classical and quantum in the decision case imply an equivalence in the sampling case? Okay. So Scott raised this question, and here it would imply that the equivalence doesn't hold, not necessarily for universal quantum circuits, but for restricted ones, okay? And so this, there's a natural question raised, does this equivalence hold in these restricted cases? But also, if we assume that this does not happen, then there's a very interesting question raised of what classical post-processing promotes this to being able to solve decision problems outside of classical. And maybe a way into this, a first step towards trying to answer this question, is to note that, this kind of scenario is not hard to believe, because maybe this example here shows that exactly that happens, right? If we take this device, we can see that with a little bit of classical post-processing, we can unlock a lot of value, right? So all we would need to do is compute the parity of the end guys and add them on, and suddenly we've got ourselves quantum decision problems, right, being solved. So this is like feasible that this might happen if we could just find the right way of classically post-processing the data. And how might we try to find that right way? Well, one interesting thing is that this notion of a polybox can be strengthened. So you recall earlier I was talking about how a polybox kind of is kind of like having the family of quantum circuits, and then something that decides whether membership in this event, right? So if you change the events that are allowed from these really simple ones that have this wildcard to more complicated ones, and we can ramp these events all the way up to the set of all languages in P. And if we do so, we are essentially have this controlled way of increasing the computational power of a polybox. And the hope would be that you can maybe show more and more existence of simulators for this family until you hit some point where you can't, and maybe you've kind of, managed to capture the computational power of these elusive and beautiful creatures by seeing what kind of post-processing makes it hard for you to simulate these things. And that's very ambitious, but it's a way forward. Okay, and with that, I'm going to open to questions.
Following up this last point, no matter how you set that, again, it will follow that the epsilon simulation gives you a strengthened polybox for any family of events?
So an epsilon simulator will always be stronger. Well, it's possible that as you ramp up this polybox, so I think I understand your question. So as you ramp up this polybox by giving it more and more events that it has to estimate the probabilities for, in the limit that you saturate the complexity of these events to everything decidable in P, you will reach the set of all decision problems that are solvable by BPP with this oracle as a sampler. Whether or not that equals epsilon simulation depends on this. Whether this equality implies this. or this difference implies this. So it's kind of like the whether equality in decision problem sense implies equality in the sampling problem sense is not clear. That's an open question. But if it did imply equality, then I think this line will hit this line when you ramp up.
Let's thank Huckle again.
Okay, thank you.